This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Daryl Chutka, a general internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. The first heart transplant patient survived only 18 days, as the early attempts of heart transplantation were plagued by immune rejection of the transplanted organ. Today, thanks to many advances in organ transplantation, heart transplant patients are able to lead productive lives for years. 75% of heart transplant patients live at least 5 years, and nearly 85% return to work. So who's a candidate for a heart transplant? How long do patients typically wait for a transplant, and when should we think about a heart transplant for our patients? These are questions I'll be asking my guest, Dr. Drew Rosenbaum, a cardiologist from the Mayo Clinic, as we discuss when to refer a patient for a heart transplant. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Talks. Drew, welcome, and thank you for joining me today. This is going to be an interesting topic.
Thanks, Darrell. I appreciate you inviting me to talk here.
Sure. Now, I seem to remember heart transplants being around a long time. When was the first one done, and what's happened with time?
Well, the first one actually was done in 1967. It was actually done in South Africa. And back in the day, heart transplants really lasted only a very short time because we didn't have an understanding really of the immune system effects that a heart transplant would incur. And the heart transplant evolution has been very dramatic. And there's been a few notable changes that have happened over time, mostly with immunosuppression, that have allowed us to allow people to have the productive lives, as you discussed.
So what are the major milestones? Is that it, learning about the immune system?
Yeah, I mean, we've learned certainly a lot about the immune system. In the 1960s, when the first one was performed, we really only had things like corticosteroids and azathioprine, and we had some lymphocyte depleting agents, but things really took off in the 80s when cyclosporin was developed, and cyclosporin really changed the face of things. One interesting kind of thing about heart transplantation is that the definition of death changed a little bit in the 80s as well, and that kind of changed our ability to utilize donors differently. And so after that, tacrolimus came in the 90s, and we've had some other changes in surgical management, like technique for transplantation, that have improved, and gradually our assessment of grading and rejection has changed. And all those things have contributed to better outcomes over time, I think.
I believe at one point in time, you required a beating heart transplant. Is that correct? And that's not true today?
Correct. Yeah. So back in the day, so death determination has been by brain death or cardiac death. We typically utilize brain dead donors these days, but there is new usage of people who've died after the heart is stopped as well, in very specific circumstances only.
So how successful is a heart transplant? How long do people typically live with one?
Yeah, good question. The lifespan for people after heart transplant has certainly been expanding over time. It's been slowly improving since the 90s, and an average person would be expected to live about 13 years right now. But we have patients who have lived more than 30 years with their heart transplantation. A lot of it has to do with other medical problems that they may develop, normal aging things. But sometimes people have complications from it, of course, too.
What's the most common reason for failure of a transplant? Let's say both the short term and then long term, if they've had it for many years.
Sure. Because people are at risk of rejection, we have to use pretty high power immunosuppression early after a transplant. So in that early phase, when they're at highest risk of rejection, we can have problems with the heart itself. So the heart can not work either because the heart doesn't work right away or because they develop rejection. But putting people on immunosuppression also puts them at high risk of infections. And so infections are one of the leading issues early on after transplant. So that first about year is what kind of the highest risk period for those kind of things. Now, over time, when we're talking about getting towards that average length that people have a heart transplant, then we start to run into a couple other issues. The one that we fear quite frequently is what's called cardiac allograft vasculopathy, fancy term meaning disease of the arteries of the heart, which is kind of a form of vascular rejection that happens over time. And we have a couple of tricks to mitigate that. And then the other thing that happens is because the immune system is involved in surveillance for cancers as well, people are a little higher risk of developing cancers, especially skin cancer, over time. So we have to watch out for that.
Okay. I didn't know a lot about heart transplantation, so I was doing some reading on it prior to the podcast, and I assumed that most transplants were done with adults, but they're done with children too. Is that right? And do children do better than adults with a transplanted organ?
Well, they can, only because they have youth on their side. Transplantation in childhood is only when it's absolutely necessary, because obviously there is a expected, you know, limitation on the graft survival after it's transplanted. And so patients transplanted in childhood very often need a retransplant, which we do sometimes for those children. So to the extent that they do better, it's because they have youth on their side mostly and not running into most of the age-related comorbidities.
Okay. So let's say you have a patient who you would feel would benefit from a heart transplant. What are the other criteria that they need to meet in order to undergo this procedure?
So a heart transplant is a fairly invasive and significant procedure. So people have to have fairly good other organs to tolerate it. And the main things we look at for criteria standpoint for a heart transplant, number one is age. There's not an absolute cutoff at our institution right now. A lot of institutions will use a hard cutoff at 70 years of age, some 65, some are more liberal. It's more about how vigorous somebody is more than the absolute age cutoff. But when we start talking about how long people can live after a heart transplant, we run into the natural life expectancy when we start transplanting people later in 70s. So therefore, we keep it to generally the low 70s or younger. People can't have other significant end organ disease unless that is also going to be transplanted concomitantly, like advanced kidney disease, advanced liver disease, advanced lung disease. All those are problematic. And it is quite a bit to take care of a transplant from a patient's perspective. And so we really also assess somebody's psychosocial capacity to be able to do that effectively. Mm-hmm. And things like substance use can often get in our way sometimes.
How about active malignancy? Is that a criteria?
Yeah. So cancer is a particular problem because when we immunosuppress somebody, that cancer will probably get worse quicker. So active cancer, in fact, most solid organ cancers within 5 years, we're cautious about considering transplant in.
Okay. What limits heart transplantation? What's the greatest factor that has an effect on who's going to get a heart transplant?
Yeah, right. Good question. So there are many more patients waiting for a heart transplant than donors that are available. That's really why the wait list exists. And it exists for every organ right now, but heart transplant waiting times exist because of lack of donor availability. We, of course, have an opt-in system for donation in our country. So you have to indicate your desire to be an organ donor. That's really what limits our ability to transplant people more. There are more good candidates probably than hearts available. That's the distinction.
Okay. What's the most common reason a patient will need a heart transplant? What cardiac disease do they typically have that we should think about a heart transplant?
So most of our transplanted patients had either dilated or ischemic cardiomyopathies. So they had a weak heart for unknown reasons or genetic reasons, or an ischemic cardiomyopathy because they had blockages in the heart arteries that caused the cardiomyopathy in the first place. We have a fairly large proportion at Mayo of congenital heart disease patients. That's actually about 20% of the transplants that we do. And then there's a kind of a smattering of others. So advanced hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, amyloid cardiomyopathy, sarcoid cardiomyopathy, sometimes genetic arrhythmias or arrhythmia syndromes in general. So we sometimes have to transplant people relatively urgently who have a lot of ventricular tachycardia, for example, inpatient. And one of the indications that most people don't think about, but actually we do occasionally, is a transplant simply for refractory angina for people who have, you know, had complete revascularization, maximal medical therapy, and still have life-limiting angina. It actually remains an indication.
So I think back and I can recall many patients I've had with chronic ischemic heart disease, congestive heart failure. And to be honest, I guess I've never really thought about a heart transplant for them. What criteria should we keep in our mind to put that at least on the list of things that we can offer our patients? What should we be looking for?
Right. So as I said, the most common reason we transplant someone is for heart failure, like you say. And what we look for are the sort of signs that somebody has reached the American Heart Association stage D heart failure. Those are things that are, for example, very limiting symptoms predominantly, dramatic dyspneic exertion, when they walk short distances, usually significant problems with fluid overload, recurrent hospitalizations. And oftentimes, you know, a cardiologist will be involved, but somebody is somebody who's on nootropic therapy or somebody in cardiogenic shock in the hospital, for example, those are all candidates. If you're an internist and wondering whether somebody should maybe be referred for a heart transplant, one of the best things you can get is a cardiopulmonary exercise test, because a peak VO2 is not only prognostic in the general population, but is very prognostic for needing a heart transplant mm-hmm. in the setting of congestive heart failure. So that's a really good one. And of course, if your patient is having a lot of ventricular tachycardia, and if, you know, a cardiologist has not thought about transplant, it may be a person who would benefit from heart transplant if these are really quite a high burden of ventricular tachycardia.
And do you want to see these patients relatively, not early, but more in their moderate stages rather than when they get to end stage?
Yeah, good question. So we have a heart failure clinic where we see anyone from stage B to stage D heart failure. So anyone from structural changes in their heart without symptoms all the way to advanced symptoms. And if somebody may be kind of on the border or moderate, then I think certainly a referral to the heart failure clinic is the way to go. From there, we can triage whether somebody looks like they might have stage D heart failure or advanced heart failure that would benefit from transplantation. And that's probably the best pathway to get us involved early from a heart failure standpoint, so we can potentially mitigate the progression to advanced heart failure needing transplant.
So when you get a new patient that has a potential for heart transplant, what evaluation are you going to do to determine go ahead or not a candidate?
We have people undergo what's called a transplant evaluation when we decide that it's probably time to at least look into whether they'd be a candidate. And that's several days of testing to assess those questions, whether they have advanced end organ disease that we talked about otherwise. Some of the testing that's kind of notable, again, we get the cardiopulmonary exercise test. Again, that tells us their objective limitation with regard to exertional capacity. We get all sorts of markers of end organ function. We understand the vasculature and the anatomy primarily for the surgeons. And then we have consultations with a number of different folks to understand, you know, infection risk. So we have an infectious disease visit with a patient. Social work and often psychiatry if there's comorbid psychosocial disease as well. And we'll get a right heart catheterization and measure invasive filling pressures. One of the contraindications that's important for us that we always think about is excessive pulmonary hypertension, because excessive pulmonary hypertension would put somebody at risk for post-transplant right heart failure in a donor heart that's not used to seeing high pressures on the right side.
I would think, and I don't know this, but I would think that there's a lot of emotion attached to receiving a heart transplant. Does that happen? And do you assess that or have a psychological assessment, or at least let the patients know, you know, what they can expect psychologically from this?
Yeah, we do have a discussion about that. And our social workers and a psychiatrist do a really great job of that. We certainly are involved in it too, because we talk about sort of what communication can happen and can't happen, and what information is available and not available about the donor. So, for example, somebody after transplant might feel a deep connection to the donor and be very grateful to the donor family, and they can write an anonymous letter to the donor family. And sometimes the donor family responds, and we've had some patients who've developed a relationship with the donor family, actually. Mm-hmm. It's also emotional from the standpoint of the fact that their old heart goes to pathology. And at our institution, we set up a viewing so that they can actually see their own heart, which is quite an emotional experience for people sometimes too.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we think of the heart as just an organ that pumps blood, but to many people, there's a much more emotional attachment. That's the heart of their soul, literally.
Right, exactly.
So how long are patients waiting to receive a heart transplant?
That's a good question. It varies a lot. And I'll tell you, it'll change again soon. Right now, patients' wait time is determined by their status. That's based on how sick they are. So there are 6 active statuses for heart transplant. The first 3 are basically people in the hospital, and statuses 4, 5, and 6 are people out of the hospital in various forms. And exactly how sick they are determines which status they'd be at. Somebody who's status 1 is somebody in hospital on ECMO, and those patients generally wait days to maybe a couple of weeks, ideally for a heart transplant on average. Whereas people in the outpatient setting who can exist outside the hospital and maintain their life there safely might wait months to low numbers of years at times. Depends on a little bit of chance, blood type, whether they have sensitization, which means antibodies to other people. So that's one of our limiting issues too. People can develop anti-HLA antibodies that limit the scope of donors that we can find for them.
Okay. So, Drew, are these lists, is it a national registry, state, or does each institution that performs heart transplants have its own list?
Yeah. So we have an internal list, but their status is registered with a national organization. That's called the United Network for Organ Sharing. It is actually a company that's contracted by the OPTN, which is a national government agency that's contracted UNOS to arrange organ allocation in the United States. So each institution maintains their wait list, but they're registered with UNOS, and UNOS coordinates the actual allocation of organs that way. So it's a complex interplay between an institution, a local organization too, which I didn't even mention, the organ procurement organization, which governs, which sort of allocates things locally, and UNOS, which oversees it all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you must have some dramatic stories of how patients' lives have been changed after receiving a transplant. Do you think of some dramatic ones?
What's really amazing about our field is seeing patients that have profound congestive heart failure have such a dramatic response and are able to live their lives. One of the things that I'm sure you know, our colleague Brooks Edwards, who recently retired,
right,
he would always talk about, I think, the third patient we ever transplanted in the late 80s, 1989. He sailed around the world after a heart transplantation. We have one guy that had severe pulmonary hypertension and actually needed a combined heart and lung transplant. He ran a half marathon within his first year after essentially triple, but basically double organ transplant.
Wow, impressive.
Very impressive stuff. I think the congenital heart disease population is a very challenging population because they've had so many surgeries and been so sick for long. Sometimes they have a very amazing appreciation of the transplant because they've been limited their entire lives in some cases, and they feel much, much better after transplant. Yeah.
So do heart transplant patients have any limitations at all on what they can do?
They sort of do, partly because we really try to limit how many organisms they encounter that may infect them. So for example, eating raw food is generally avoided, and we ask people to cook their food and be cautious with things even like gardening and things, you know, because that can expose them to parasites in the soil and fungi in the soil, especially here in the upper Midwest. So there are some minor limitations, but by and large, people can live a pretty normal life, although they have to see us in clinic a little bit more than they probably would want to, but
sure,
at least initially. But life can get back to pretty normal status after everything is healed up. And over the long term, we tend to follow people every year if people are going, doing well, and we see them once a year.
Well, what do you see for the future? Does it look pretty positive? Are there some things you're concerned about? What's the future look like for heart transplantation?
No, the future is definitely bright. There's a couple of things that are probably going to change how we do transplant. The first is, I alluded to that the organ allocation will change a little bit. We're not going to have these statuses in a couple of years. We're going to go to a score, much like if you wear the MELD score for liver transplant, we're going to go to a kind of a continuous score. MELD is a risk prediction tool, but we're going to go to a continuous allocation score such that we're going to put different variables and patients will be ranked by what score they get. So that'll change things in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And that'll change kind of how we think about pre-transplant management a little bit too. There's some interesting devices that are coming online to allow us to preserve organs more safely for longer so that we can get hearts that are appropriate for a patient from further or at least more safely from close. There's already something called a heart in a box, which is a colloquial term for TransMedics' OCS device. The heart beats inside, you know, in this box as it's transported. And there's fancier forms of cold storage. Our hearts are typically transported or conventionally have been transported on ice, but there's more clever methods to do cold preservation too that are coming online. So preservation will be a big thing too. You also may have heard about in the news these two patients at the University of Maryland that have received organs from pigs. First happened last year, I think. And the second one just happened a month ago or so. And Xenotransplantation, as it's called, getting organs from animals, may become a reality eventually. Presumably, it might happen during my career. And the challenge is that there are many portions of the extracellular matrix and antigens that are difficult to fully account for. And, you know, we've learned a lot, certainly from the first case of it. That patient only lived 60 days after transplant, but it was certainly a feat. The second patient is, from what I understand, doing well still. But the more we learn about that, it took a combination of, I think, 9 or 10 gene knock-ins and knockouts of the donor pig to even be able to attempt it. But it is a fascinating frontier. And there are other sort of genetic technologies that may offer us possibility to do either a xenotransplantation or perhaps even grow one's own heart is the dream. But that's only a pie-in-the-sky idea right now.
Well, certainly transplanting animal hearts would really do a lot to improve the organ availability for transplants.
Exactly right, yeah.
Well, Drew, this has been a fascinating discussion. Can you kind of summarize what we've talked about, maybe 2 or 3 key points?
Sure. When you're thinking about your patients and whether they need a heart transplant, look for patients who seem to be having progressive congestive heart failure type symptoms, and you're having increasing difficulty managing them. Think about people who are having a lot of ventricular arrhythmias or people in hospital who you're seeing that might have some component of cardiogenic shock. But recognize that we do have limitations with regard to transplant, both in organ availability and think about people's end organ function and whether that might be adequate. And feel free to call us, you know, if there's a patient that you want to assess whether they'd be a candidate for transplant.
Okay.
And to keep in mind these future technologies that may offer a broader scope for transplant, and we'll certainly try to project that these are new opportunities if they come online.
We've been discussing when to refer a patient for a heart transplant with cardiologist Dr. Drew Rosenbaum from the Mayo Clinic. Drew, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Daryl, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You can now listen to several hundred different medical topics developed for primary care providers on Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts. Find them at ce.mayo.edu or your favorite podcasting app. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts, please follow us. We're honored to have you as a listener and hope you tune in again next week. Stay well.